W.G. Rogers defends Gertrude Stein and meets critics Virgilia Peterson and Ludwig Lewison on The Author Meets the Critics. Welcome to The Author Meets the Critics, where the nation's top writers meet their severest critics face-to-face, no holds barred. But first, meet the man who keeps the peace on these programs, your regular chairman, John K.M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. No writer in our times has been more abused, misunderstood, and at the same time so greatly revered as Gertrude Stein. Some have said she's a great poet, and here is an example from her Portraits and Prayers. 40 make 3 run, 40 make 4 among, 30 make 22 and bring, 20 make 5 of 21, and 6 make 26 and sung. That's a sample of Gertrude Stein's work. Those and more, phrases which have become classics in American literature, a rose is a rose is a rose, and pigeons in the grass, alas, alas. If you understand Gertrude Stein, much less appreciate her, you will be interested in our author of the afternoon and his new book, When This You See, Remember Me. Here to defend Gertrude Stein and to tell us about this book is the literary editor of the Associated Press, Mr. W.G. Rogers.
The big question about Gertrude Stein is now and always has been, was she a genius? She unhesitatingly said yes. Some other people said yes, some definitely no. But everyone would agree that she did have one kind of genius, a genius for getting into trouble. Even today, 2 years after her death, it is generally supposed that her natural habitat was hot water. So I wrote my book hoping to cool the water, to silence some of the complaints and accusations. Or I wrote it perhaps as a red herring. If they know about my dear friend Gertrude, I imagined, maybe they'll stop finding fault with Stein. It may divert them from angry questions about automatic or cubist writing, or from asking what in heaven's name can be the meaning of such books as Tender Buttons, Lucy Church Amiably, The Making of Americans, or the lecture about The Making of Americans, which she entitled, as she would, The Making of the Making of Americans. For her last 30 years on and off, I knew her. And how I knew her and what I saw and heard and read in her letters are the principal material in the book. I tell what she was like, how her days rolled past in what she called her daily island living, how she talked and what she said, how she got along with her bosom friend Alice Toklas, and how they got along, or did not get along, with other people from obscure World War I doughboys and World War II GIs to the great composers, artists, and writers. My little scheme did not work. Gertrude the woman is helplessly a part of Stein the writer. Her daily island living inevitably shows through on innumerable pages in her books. Some people who read my book clenched their fists, gritted their teeth, and jumped back into the fray with both feet. The water that was hot now boiled, and the argument, if we can trust Miss Peterson, as I am very much afraid we can, goes on as furiously as ever.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers, and now you must meet your critics, yours and Gertrude Stein's. First, the distinguished novelist, editor, and reviewer, Miss Virgilia Peterson.
I want to boil, Mr. Rogers, but first of all, I'd like to say that you have written a tribute here to a friend who died with considerable courage, and for that, you are to be praised. It is a tribute, and a tribute is a praiseworthy thing, and so we will praise this tribute to write in your own style. But what really happens is that it doesn't quite come off as a tribute to Miss Stein as a writer. I can't quite swallow the way you talk about Miss Stein, your opinion of her work, the extraordinary way in which you elevate the capricious trivialities, the naughty, naughty childishness, and the arrogant obviousness inherent in Miss Stein's work. I must say I had a distinct shock to find you, for whose literary judgment and perception I have always had, as a matter of fact, quite a good deal of respect, singing so coyly, so tenderly throughout this little book about the miracle of Miss Stein. And I was just wondering if by any chance it was because you found her when you were a lonely doughboy. You found her with Miss Toklas. I was wondering if perhaps you'd found a two-headed mother and had never been able to rid yourself of this delightful trauma into which they put you.
Well, Miss Peterson, I would say that that was in the vein. Now, our other critic is one of the outstanding novelists of our times, one of the great writers of our generation, the author of The Island Within, The Case of Mr. Crump, and a dozen great novels, Ludwig Lewison.
Mr. Rogers' book about Gertrude Stein seems to be more than anything else a book about France. As such, it has a delicate, evocative quality and a charming iridescence. What you are made to feel, especially if you share the feeling, is Miss Stein's and her friends' love of France, of the French sense of life and the French landscape. Anyone who has ever lived in Montparnasse and has seen and loved and lingered in Arles to the very hotel and Avignon and even Aigues-Mortes and the ruined mansions of Les Baux can't read these pages without a certain nostalgia. Very wisely, Mr. Rogers avoids all controversy concerning Miss Stein's writings, which he likes, and which someone else may like less well, by his definitive statement on page 72. It is the world of disintegration, bursting apart, explosion and collapse, of tremendous political, economic, and ideological, as well as artistic changes. We are the one-horse show. So what we have is that France, which so many of us loved, has seen and experienced by a very interesting and a very salient character. Gertrude Stein was assuredly that. Mr. Rogers conveys her quality, as I think no one else has done. Her virile independence of spirit, her rough kindliness, her categorical speech, as of a not wholly feminine Dr. Johnson, even though she wore petticoats. And what Mr. Rogers gives us, too, though he may not quite have meant it, is a happy and nostalgic vision of his own youth in France, and it was very wonderful to be young in France during those years. I should say, then, that the book is a valuable contribution to the chronicle of a period and of a place. I like it much better than Cicely Huddleston's heavy anecdotage or Sam Putnam's bitterish chronicle. I like it better in a sense than even Eliot Paul's rather overfelt and overdone The Last Time I Saw Paris. What may be called the transition episode of American culture may not have been exactly a world-shaking thing, but it is of some memorableness within the history of American civilization. And as a contribution to it, Mr. Rogers' book has real value.
Well, I think that there is no doubt about the fact that we have a real difference of opinion and people who can express that difference of opinion. What do you think of the book which Dr. Lewison has described, Miss Peterson?
I don't recognize it. About France? Yes, he's evocative, as all Baedeker's guides are evocative of the beautiful architectural souvenirs of an ancient civilization, to be like the Pont du Gard and the other great buildings to be found around Nîmes and Arles. But what he really talks about is how much food you can get for how little money. That seems to be what most people talk about when they go to Europe. It's miraculous how they return to that. Food, food, food. Mr. Rogers, you must have been awfully hungry.
All starving writers are very
much... Mr. Rogers, you aren't even... You're just listening at this point.
I beg your pardon.
What I can understand that a rather rotund lady who has no other responsibilities in life except to feed what she considers her genius would go staring mad over a melon, the size of that melon, and the pinching of the ends of it to determine its value as a melon. But what I cannot understand is how a young doughboy or an enterprising writer, or in any case a man with such a sensible face as you have and such a lean anatomy, could rave and rant so interminably about melon, and all the other things which seem to make you drool at the mouth in an unbecoming fashion.
Well, do you want to make any comment on this gourmet's delight that Miss Peterson has described, Dr. Lewison?
Why, I am devoted to food.
Oh, Mr. Lewison, and I thought you were spiritual.
French food.
I thought you were spiritual.
And especially to French food, but I didn't get a succulent impression from this book at all.
It might not have been the food you liked, Mr. Lewison.
I don't remember a single dish mentioned in it.
Gracious, but look and hear. He quotes what Miss Stein herself wrote about melons. Now, if you can understand this, to introduce a melon, two melons, to introduce two melons, sugared melons, candied melons, where are they? To them, to introduce them, to produce for them, to send to them a melon, to send them, to send melons, two melons to them, this makes them give you their blessing. Now, if you can take those melons, and upon which Mr. Rogers says, that adds up to only a dozen or so melons, and we had many more than that.
Well, you see, Miss Peterson, melons are very good and very amusing, but they never strike me as food in that particular sense.
What you need is a real beefsteak.
No, rognon à la casa, for instance.
Well, I wonder if we could talk either about Mr. Rogers' book or about Miss Stein.
I've been talking about Mr. Rogers' book and Miss Stein. This last sentence, in case you thought I made it up, I didn't.
Well, I admit you've been sinking your teeth into it, Miss Peterson. I think that that's the proper image to carry on here. But what about the case of... the case of Dr. Lewison. Here is his analogy between Gertrude Stein and Dr. Johnson, the great 18th century figure, literary personality. Do you think that is justified, Miss Peterson?
No, I'm afraid I don't. I know that Miss Stein had a good deal of information, though it doesn't seem to me that she did know so awfully much about anybody who painted before Picasso or anybody who wrote before Miss Stein. It does strike you that for a world culture figure to date everything from the period of her own fruition, as it were, is a little odd.
Melon fruition. Well, the kind of fruit, I presume you mean.
It's a fruity subject, all told. I don't know. I don't hold with the idea that Miss Stein is a Dr. Johnson. I think Miss Stein must have been an awfully nice woman, and I know very well that she had green fingers. Now, this is not a melon image. As regards other writers, that she did do something in a way to stimulate other writers, that she pointed out to Mr. Hemingway that if he wrote, he said, she said, long enough and firmly enough, he would make a lot of money. I was, by the way, quite interested in a slight and very tactfully handled comment of Mr. Rogers that Miss Stein, before her own bursting forth into success on a lecture tour in America, was just a little sour grapes, I'm sorry to get back to fruit again, about the amount of money that Mr. Hemingway and Mr. Bromfield and some of her other protégés had been able to rake in after she had set fire to them, as it were, and launched them on their careers. That interested
Dr.
me very
Rogers?
Much.
Well, as I said, quoting from Mr. Rogers' book, Gertrude Stein was a part of the disintegration of modern culture. The one horse shay. That is the happiest and most penetrating remark, not directly on his subject that Mr. Rogers makes in the book. I am unwilling to engage in a discussion of Miss Stein's work, except insofar as it is a part of that modern disintegration. Therefore, Miss Peterson, I don't hold it against her, she being what she was, that her knowledge of painting began with Picasso and her knowledge of literature obviously with her own writings.
No, but I hold it against Mr. Rogers that he takes that seriously and quietly remarks that in just as the newspaper clippings and bits of cellophane and, for all I know, ladies' love locks, which Picasso sticks to his canvas and paints around, or has done certain times, just as he did that, so Miss Stein wrote, that had the same relative importance, that she was these newspaper
clippings. Well, I think
that
we have to find out just how important Mr. Rogers does think these things are. So it's time now to hear from the author of When This You See, Remember Me, Mr. W.G. Rogers.
I was beginning to wonder whether I wasn't going to be allowed to get into this or not.
Oh, yes, you're a little under the usual deadline, as a matter of fact, Mr. Rogers. Go ahead.
It seems to me that Miss Stein's influence has been, as Miss Peterson says, implies, and as Dr. Lewison says, very, very extensive, very profound, not only on Hemingway, but also on Sherwood Anderson, and on a great many young writers in our time. Men now living, men even sometimes now turning out their first novels. You find in their works traces of the Stein influence. To find fault with Miss Stein because she doesn't antedate Miss Stein is probably the same as finding fault with any writer. All writers begin with themselves. It's always been true of the important people, the people whether they were influential or not, the people who felt that they were dedicated to literature felt that there was no literature except what they contributed. As Picasso, I'm sure, feels that probably the only important painter is Picasso.
Anybody wanted
I am sorry, Mr. Rogers. I cannot defend you on that statement. Only the innovators ever felt that way, and the innovators were never the important people. Shakespeare took over the Elizabethan play in the blank verse. Goethe took over every form. All the great masters have taken over the forms and have been the continuation of a tradition. Which is not to say that innovators are not extremely interesting people. But this is a footnote to your observation.
Go ahead, Mr. Rogers.
It seems to me that I'm sorry to disagree with my defending critic.
Does that mean you agree with me, Mr. Rogers?
It does not agree, Miss Peterson. It does not mean that I agree with you. The innovator seems to me to be the important person, not only in painting but also in writing. The man who follows the innovator is the easy man to understand. His contribution has somehow compromised between the innovation made by the great inventor and the level of appreciation that the public has reached, so that it's able to, it finds a big audience. But the person who innovates, the Picasso, the Stein, the Joyce, those are the people who are important in literary tradition.
But what has Miss Stein innovated? Look, there's a popular show going on Broadway just now, and there's one skit in it is of a man who goes to sleep or tries to go to sleep in a very comfortable hotel, and through a loudspeaker, a psychologist is putting him to sleep and says, "Now you will sleep, you will have a fine night, dreamless in your wonderful, comfortable bed." And then he goes on and says, "And in the morning you will wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up," and the record gets stuck. The man goes crazy, jumps out of bed, and leaves the room. That is the effect of Miss Stein. If that is a literary innovation or a spiritual innovation or any kind of a new idea, I will eat what used to be called in old-fashioned days my shirt.
One of the hungry critics.
We're getting away from the book. Are you suggesting, Miss Peterson, that Mr. Rogers should have written a book called Inside Gertrude Stein?
Well, I wouldn't be so bold.
And to clothe it in your Eton shirt.
May I reinterpret what I think she's done in another way? Years ago when I was in college, one of my professors was stark young, and he told this story. The first time I ever heard it, though I've heard it several times since. He said a foreigner came to this country. I believe he identified him as an Italian. He was unfamiliar with English, and he said, "The most beautiful word in the English language," said this Italian, "is cellar door." Cellar door to me, a boy, had never meant anything but the way down to the furnace or the way to find the lawnmower. A cellar door somehow became an entrance into a new world. And I think that's exactly what Stein has done with words for us. She has opened up a new world for us. Cellar door means more to me than it ever did before, and so do many of the words that Stein uses, because she's torn the veil off the Webster sense and given them an added life and a vitality, or renewed the life and vitality that they originally had.
Is your idea of renewing words to remove their meaning entirely and leave one at a total loss for words? Because then we might just as well all make just grunts. How about the sudden spoon is the wound in the decision? Please, a round, it is a ticket. Oh, chance to say, oh, nice old pole. What kind of a pole do you suppose she was talking to? Chestnut valuable.
Slide down him, I presume.
Be papered. These excerpts which you have chosen, they are, of course, a change from Webster, a decided revolution. But generally a revolution brings something new into the world. I cannot see what she has brought new. The simple distortion is so childish.
Of course, as Dr. Lewison said, a revolution also may take something else out of the world.
Oh, nothing is gained without a loss, but I see no gain or any loss here.
I want Mr. Rogers to stick to his passage on page 72.
You want to talk about dissolution again,
Dr. Lewison?
No, I
don't want to talk about dissolution. I want us all to agree, or as many of us as will agree, that Gertrude Stein was a phenomenon of dissolution.
Yes, he somewhere said that tongue.
Of the collapse of civilization and of culture, that is the excellent symbol of the one house shade. That being granted, it's a delightful book about an interesting person having interesting experiences. I thought I could take this for granted, that we did not have to glorify Gertrude Stein.
But Mr. Rogers does just that. He refers with such utter respect to her. He quotes these letters from her when she came over here to America on her lecture trip. Dear Kitty, note the rather maternal element, she always called him Kitty. Kitty, it was wonderful, it was wonderful, it was wonderful. Everybody loved me, it was wonderful. Going on, and he thinks it's rather touching. He says, of course, he says that her satisfaction knew no bounds. Her appetite, this time not for food, mind you, but her appetite for recognition was boundless. And he seems to think that that is okay. He doesn't remember about humility. Don't you think that most people have to have humility, too, if they really have stature?
No, I don't.
You don't?
No.
Well,
no.
I guess you're more modern than I am.
No.
They do have humility, Miss Peterson. They do have humility. They have humility, people of that kind. They have humility before their own ideals.
Of course, that's the kind
before
of humility
their own
to
ideals.
Which I
and
was referring.
Probably Gertrude Stein had this, that her lack of humility is in respect of the immediate scene of life. For instance, I find it extremely touching and really very cute that she was put out because those young men whom she seems to have influenced were making a great deal of money and she wasn't making any money at all. I thought that was one of those touches of human nature which really does make us all very much akin. I didn't object to that.
In other words, you like human fallibility. Well, there's an awful lot of it all around. There's another place where Mr. Rogers says, in defense, I presume, of his heroine, creative ability in the raw is nothing to inspire affection. All right, I'll agree with that. But then he goes on and says, Miss Stein's friends loved her because, and then he lists why. She bought enough melons for a fruit store. Because she spoiled her dogs. Because she was so vain about being photographed. Because she had to have Maillan to eat, and because she was such a trial to Miss Toklas. Now, if those are reasons for making rousing affection in people, all of us could have a host of friends, because we're all small potatoes in one way or another. You picked
I
out
wish
the small.
We can get at these prices.
I cannot
we can
get
away
from food.
Food. I realize.
You see, all the images are in food, so, and my mind being single track.
Well, Mr. Rogers, you have given considerable tribute here on the program and in the book to Miss Stein as an innovator. And I wonder, however, if her actual achievements as an innovator are as great as you make out. After all, none of the things that you claim she did for literature had not been done by James Joyce and done with considerably more scholarship and literary genius than she. Why do you ascribe these innovations to Gertrude Stein and not to the great innovator, James Joyce?
Well, as a matter of fact, of course, she did her innovating at the time Joyce was doing his. For instance, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Boy and Her Three Lives both came out in the first decade of the century, and I don't think Miss Stein was reading Joyce at that time, nor do I think Joyce was reading Miss Stein. And besides that, Mr. McCaffrey, the innovations are not the same.
No, I don't think they're the same either.
I'm sorry, I thought you said
that. No, I said that one was an inferior type of innovation, and one was the innovation that a great linguist and a great master of the language would bring to words.
Well, then I don't agree with you saying that Miss Stein's innovation is an inferior innovation. It's a different sort of an innovation. I see no sense. Just because Joyce was a scholar and knew half a dozen languages seems to me not to prove that he was any greater a creative artist than Gertrude Stein, who knew some English, but very little French.
I'd like to go back on the Dr. Johnson thing because I was too slow to pick it up when Dr. Lewison produced it. One of the great differences, besides the very obvious one, between that gentleman and Miss Stein were the fact that he worked like a dog, or else I'm mistaken. He worked so hard that he had to pay for his grandmother's funeral by writing one of his best books, and he had to write it for about 56 hours on end or something. He worked all the time, and he suffered acutely from poverty and dirt and everything that goes with it. Miss Stein, as you so carefully point out, was a rentier. Miss Stein had an income. She was able to collect pictures. Later, during this recent war, she had a tough time and had to sell those pictures, and sometimes they really didn't have enough melons. But on the whole, Miss Stein knew where her next meal was coming from and was not quite a professional writer in that sense, apart from any other. She could afford to wait till she was 60 to get the recognition she sought so much. She did not have the pistol at her back for security, and she was not working for a living, and I think that ought to be taken into consideration in
judging. Well, I think it's only valid, Miss Peterson, if the dilettante attitude comes through in her writing.
Well, that, of course, seems to me the most obvious thing about Miss Stein.
My comparison of her to Dr. Johnson, Miss Peterson, was purely as a kind of amiable dictator in a drawing room.
And in the profile.
And in the profile, and in the profile. I never met Miss Stein, although I lived in the Rue Campagne Première, which is just around the corner from the Rue de Fleurus. But since I had something of a salon there, you see, we never met.
I think it's extremely generous of you to be willing to defend this book in those circumstances.
So we never met. Mr. Joyce used to come to my house after many diplomatic arrangements had been made. But that was impossible with Miss Stein. But the impression I get from this book and from other stories that I have heard, but primarily from this book, is that of a rather amiably dictatorial, edgy person. And that's all that I meant by the comparison with Dr. Johnson.
Well, here is her great discovery, and this one really is touching, I think. She's famous for it, according to Mr. Rogers. She says, "I am because my little dog knows me," said Gertrude Stein, to establish her own identity, to prove that Gertrude Stein was Gertrude Stein. Had she never heard of Descartes? Do you think that "I think, therefore I am" is perhaps a discovery that she might have taken into consideration? I think "I am because my little dog knows me" as an expression of an innovation of thought and literature really takes the cake.
Mr. Rogers.
And that's the last time I'm going to bring up any food at all, I promise you.
Mr. Rogers, do you care to comment on that particular statement?
Yes. I don't see why you object to fundamental philosophical statement, which wasn't Stein's originally. I think it reads, because my little dog knows me or loves me.
Did I leave an eye out? I'm sorry.
I think. It seems to me a simple statement of one of the fundamental things that we're puzzled about. Who are we?
Well, an absurd statement of one of the fundamental things we're puzzled about doesn't seem to me to rate the credit that you give her for it. I don't see why we have to descend to absurdities when life is as difficult as it is. That she takes an obvious thing and renders it ridiculous.
One, I don't recall giving her too much credit for it because I don't think it's her own statement.
Well, it's in quotes, Mr. Rogers.
That's right,
But 94.
I mean, you're quite right about that. But I mean that she didn't originate the statement. It's a statement that's it's one of the statements that always comes up in Philosophy 1 in sophomore classes in college, and she picked it up
comes
there.
Comes up before that, when you're all alone in your crib at a very tender age, I think. Kitty, you ought to know that.
I'm sure. I'm sure she loved it because the dog in it.
Well, I think that there's been accusation from Miss Peterson and implications of it all the time that actually Miss Stein was a very trivial person. Do you think that she was more than trivial, aside from her questionable literary contribution, Mr. Roger?
I resent that leading question.
Yes, it's a very leading question. It's really unfair. Do you want to twist it around?
You should never ask anybody a question like that about their spiritual mother.
Well, I'm giving Mr. Rogers a limited chance to rephrase.
My spiritual aunt, I call her in the book. As a matter of fact, there was nothing trivial.
And I'm afraid that, as a matter of fact, we're going to have to tell Miss Peterson and Mr. Rogers, Mr. Lewis, and the time's up for everybody. And here is Bob Sherry to tell you what lies ahead on The Author Meets the Critics.
Next week, The Author Meets the Critics turns to the story of a famous American family in the setting of the theater with all the tradition, wit, grease paint, footlights, and opening nights. The book is Family Circle, and the author is Cornelia Otis Skinner, the writer of Our Hearts Were Young and Gay. Family Circle threatens to reach the same bestseller heights, so be sure to join us. And now back to John McCaffrey.
And I might say, in that Family Circle, that Ilka Chase will be one of our critics. Now, before closing, I'd like to thank W.G. Rogers for coming here today to discuss his book, When This You See, Remember Me, and to thank you, Virgilia Peterson, and you, Ludwig Lewison, for joining us. And incidentally, friends of The Author Meets the Critics will be interested and pleased, as we were, to see the two-page spread in today's issue of Parade Magazine, which is a weekly feature in papers throughout the country. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone, directed by Arthur Austin. This is Bob Sherry speaking.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.